Das ist Bern einfach. Jeden Tag die richtige Dosis Politik vom Nebelspalter. Kritisch und unabhängig.
Der Podcast wird gesponsert von Auditswiss, Ihrer Experte rund ums Thema Revision und Wirtschaftsprüfung. www.auditswiss.ch.
Das ist Bern einfach Spezial vom Nebelspalter mit Markus Somm und Michael Schellenberger. Michael Schellenberger ist einer der bekanntesten konservativen liberal-konservativen Journalisten in Amerika, hat sehr viele sehr gute Bücher geschrieben über Umweltpolitik, aber auch über San Francisco und so weiter. Und wir führen jetzt ein Gespräch vor allem über Free Speech, weil das ist ein großes Thema in Amerika und bei uns natürlich auch. Michael Schellenberger, welcome in Switzerland. We are very, very pleased that you are sitting here in our nice office in the middle of Zurich and how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here and I appreciate the invitation.
Thank you very much. And I think I have to tell that our viewers that Michael Schellenberger, everybody who knows German knows Schellenberger. That sounds very German, even Swiss German probably. His heritage is Swiss. His ancestors came to Switzerland, to the United States in the 17th century. Is that
early
true?
18th.
Right?
Early
because,
18th.
Because we persecuted. Yeah. Mennonites. So I'm really sorry, and this is not an official story by Markus Somm. No, you were one of the few and only journalists studying the Twitter files. What was your impression? Was it a shock, or did you expect what you were seeing?
Well, first, I think it's important to have some context here, which is that Twitter, it's now been renamed X, is owned by Elon Musk. It is not the largest social media platform, but I think many people feel like it's the most influential media platform, particularly for news. And it was purchased by Elon Musk in 2022. He paid about three times more than it was worth. And his concern was censorship. And he took control in November of 2022. And he invited in independent journalists. I want to stress that we were all independent and have never worked for Elon Musk, have no agenda.
Did he pay you for
no,
that?
No, absolutely right. Not. And we would not accept funding. But it's an extraordinary opportunity because we had full access to really whatever files we wanted to look at. And the first thing we discovered was that the company is very far left, I would say. I think over 98% of the political donations went to Democrats. You have to remember that the Twitter at the time had censored people. It had censored a feminist, someone I know from Canada, who said, "But men can't be women," in reference to the transgender controversy. It censored the current director of the National Institutes of Health, which is the governmental funded organization in the United States that spends $40 billion a year on health research, Jay Bhattacharya. They censored him during COVID. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but one of the first things that we discovered is that he was on a blacklist, and it was actually called a blacklist inside of Twitter. They had censored accurate information around the COVID vaccine, mm-hmm. including information by a Harvard professor who said that children don't need the COVID vaccine. That's now the official policy of the United States government. That was the policy of many European governments at the time, and they censored that individual.
And it was far-reaching. Even in Europe, they censored, you know, people who were not agreeing with the official policy in COVID.
That's right. Mm. So we discovered those things, but then something else happened that was a surprise, which was that when there were just two of us that were left in the Twitter headquarters, other journalists had come and gone. We discovered a large number of emails from intelligence and security agencies, including in particular the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, which is the federal agency that was created after 9/11 to engage in countering domestic terrorism threats. And what we discovered in brief was a very elaborate operation by the US government to create and fund at least four separate NGOs, ostensibly independent non-governmental organizations, to flag or draw attention to or propose to be censored thousands, of social media posts, thousands of tweets. And this was very shocking for us in the United States. The First Amendment is extremely strong. The law is that the government shall take no action to infringe, or we say abridge, freedom of expression. The law is also clear that the government cannot empower others to infringe on freedom of expression. And what they were essentially trying to do was a workaround and get around the First Amendment by having supposedly private actors to engage in the censorship. Mm. We also discovered that several of those non-governmental organizations had very close ties to the intelligence community. One of the principal leaders of that effort worked at the CIA, has now said that she worked at the CIA for 5 years. We know that people that work for the CIA are allowed by law to lie about their own involvement in the intelligence community. That's absolutely allowed. And understandably so. I'm not even sure I'm against it, but it is something that raises questions. And that the other NGOs involved are all intermediaries to the intelligence community. One of them is the Atlantic Council, which is an organization that works heavily in Europe as well. And that was a big discovery. They engaged in a censorship operation during COVID and also during the 2020 elections. And then I think one of the most important cases that people might have heard about is that there was censorship of the computer laptop belonging to the son of the former president. That's Hunter Biden. And this laptop, which was actually two separate disk drives, had been brought into a computer repair store owner in Delaware, which is where the president, the former president, lived. And what they showed was very clearly an influence peddling operation on the part of the son of the president to sell access to his father and presumably policy actions or regulatory actions by the vice president. He was at the time vice president, in exchange for money that went to Hunter Biden. And this was, we're talking tens of millions of dollars, including coming from senior officials in the Chinese, in Chinese businesses that are tied to the Chinese military.
To put it bluntly, it's corruption.
It's corruption.
It is corruption.
Yeah. It is corruption. And it's, you know, it's not, there's a lot of ways in which it's illegal. It's unethical for sure.
Absolutely.
And this laptop, just to provide some context, was given to a computer repair store owner by Hunter Biden in December of 2019. It was actually given to him in earlier in 2019. And then the computer repair store owner gave them to the FBI in December of 2019. In 2020, the FBI was spying on Rudy Giuliani, who was an advisor to President Trump. Rudy Giuliani during 2020 was trying to find a news outlet to cover the laptop. And during 2020, the FBI directly engaged in what is referred to in the intelligence community as an information operation, or sometimes it's called an influence operation or a disinformation operation, that had a clear aim to associate, misinform people as to the origins of the laptop. And the goal was to make people think that the laptop had been a result of a hack by Russians. And so we saw multiple FBI efforts. The first is the FBI gave a briefing to two U.S. senators who were investigating Hunter Biden and his business dealings with a Ukrainian natural gas company called Burisma. They then leaked that information to the news media, which then wrote a story supposedly about how the FBI was worried about Russian involvement in Hunter Biden's affairs. Stanford University then came out with a report that urged journalists to, when they covered hacked information, to cover the hack rather than the information. So sort of priming people, preparing the minds of people. And then the most extraordinary discovery, and it was the most important of the Twitter files that I did, was an effort by the Aspen Institute, which I think people think of as a kind of Davos or World Economic Forum, but an effort by the staff of the Aspen Institute to mentally prepare, through two separate briefings, journalists and social media company content moderators that lead censors in the social media companies, to prepare them to cover a hack and leak operation by the Russians as it related to Hunter Biden and the Ukrainian natural gas companies, these briefings would never have been discovered had it not been for the Twitter files. And the clear effort was to mislead people about the Hunter Biden laptop, which then was eventually released in October. At that time, when the Hunter Biden story was published in the New York Post in late October, the New York Post published the receipt from the computer repair store. It published the receipt from the FBI. Nobody denied that this was Hunter Biden's laptop. Nobody denied that the FBI had taken possession of it in December of 2019. And yet all of the news media, I mean, it was really 100% of the news media said there's something fishy about this story. It appears to be tied to a Russian hack and leak operation. Also at that moment, and this is something we discovered and only could have discovered through the Twitter files, the former general counsel to the FBI, the top attorney to the FBI, who had left the FBI in the summer of 2020, argued internally inside Twitter that they should censor the New York Post story about the Hunter Biden laptop. This was after, despite all of the Aspen Institute, they call it pre-bunking or you call it brainwashing. After all of that, the Twitter content moderation staff, the top Twitter censors, had evaluated the story and had come to a consensus view within the company that the story did not violate Twitter's hacked materials policy. The former FBI general counsel, working as the deputy general counsel inside Twitter, persuaded the executives of Twitter to countermand, to override the conclusion of the content moderation staff, and Twitter did censor the story. And I think that the final punchline to this all is that this is an extremely sophisticated information operation by what is called a deep state government organization, the FBI. They didn't succeed in censoring the story because the story had been published in the New York Post. What they had succeeded in doing is shaping the public perception of it.
Absolutely.
So that even people that were critical of the Biden administration and suspected corruption, like myself, thought that there was something wrong with the story and that it probably originated from the Russians.
Now, the interesting thing is actually you were saying that this cooperation between the intelligence services and those social media, I presume it's not only Twitter,
No. It's
also Facebook and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It started actually before Trump and it started also before COVID.
Yeah.
What was actually the motivation? What was originally the motivation of the intelligence community to have this kind of cooperation?
Well, on the one hand, it appears that much of the demand for censorship begins in 2016 mm-hmm. as a reaction from the intelligence community to the election of Trump.
So it was partisan. In the beginning, it was partisan.
It was partisan, and you might even say it was counter-populism.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a reaction to Brexit. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, the effort from the intelligence community, and this was a whole separate issue, was to brand Trump as a puppet of Putin. And this is a very brilliant idea because the strength of Trump, as most people now know, is that he was a nationalist and he was a populist. In other words, the argument that Trump was making to the American people was that he was loyal to the American people, and Biden and the Democrats and Hillary Clinton were compromised from their funding from others, including a significant fee that Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton's husband, received from the Russians. So most people now think that the origins of the Russia collusion hoax really began as a defensive campaign trick by the Clinton campaign to defend themselves against the accusation that they were compromised by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's also worth pointing out, though, that really, it goes back further. If you go all the way back to after World War II, the United States decided that it did not want to fight a third world war. It wanted to proactively prevent the rise of populism and nationalism in Europe, as well as to stem the rise of communism. We know now it's not controversial that the CIA interfered in the Italian elections of 1947, interfered in elections in Greece, and has engaged in election interference in many governments around the world for many decades, much of which is well documented and some of which is still hidden. So what appears to have occurred and this is not just my conclusion, this is the conclusion of many other scholars that have looked at it, is that those tools that the United States government had used to manipulate foreign government elections turned inward after 2016, and that the intelligence community viewed the rise of populism in the form of Trump and the MAGA movement as a threat to the international order. And that this was, you know, you could say it's driven by irrational concerns, you could say it's driven by rational concerns, but it appears to be that they justified it to themselves as an effort to prevent the collapse of the global order, including the role of NATO and the European Union.
I mean, I think this is easy to understand in a way, because all those global elites, and of course, those Americans were part of this kind of globalist elite and so on, they were really scared of Trump. I can understand that. But I'm really surprised, actually, that you are saying it's going back, way back. It's going back to the 50s and so on. And I think, I'm not so sure if I agree, but you know it better. But I really think, you know, in the 50s, it was so harder to manipulate people than nowadays, I would say, because the technological means are so more sophisticated. I mean, even just the fact that here in Switzerland, we are also customers of Twitter, Facebook, and so on, that's new. In the 50s, we only had our newspapers, and if you were lucky, you could read the New York Times. That was very old, actually, when you had it.
Yeah.
So in a way, I'm not so sure if this is such an old tradition, or if it's just very typical for the 90s, where you have this kind of global, very powerful position of the US. And in a way, it seems to be totally arrogant, actually, to think you can manipulate everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth remembering that the news media had different phases. The news media until World War I, in the United States in particular, was extremely free. Mm-hmm. And of course, freedom is the most important value in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's tied to free speech. It's also tied to free enterprise. America is, I think, culturally an isolationist country. Mm-hmm. It's a country created by people that were escaping Europe.
Absolutely. They were fed up. They were fed up, like the Mennonites. They were fed That's up right. with Europe. I can understand.
They wanted religious freedom. They wanted media freedom. And they wanted market freedom. Right. And America has a very strong commercial culture, obviously. But the news media was very decentralized. Mm. Even to World War I, and the problem identified by the leadership of the United States was that Americans did not want to go to fight World War I. Mm. And so there was at that point an effort by psychologists, sociologists, and other elites that said we need to have the U.S. government involved in manufacturing consent, meaning we don't want to, you know, we want to protect our democracy, but we need to openly manipulate public opinion. Mm-hmm. That worked in World War I. World War II, obviously, was assisted by the Japanese catastrophic error to bomb Pearl Harbor. But that agenda of manufacturing consent was the elite policy after World War II as well. Mm-hmm. And there was a high level of control, and some of it was direct. We do know that the CIA had journalists in different news media outlets, including the New York Times. That's not a controversial claim. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it was more social. You know, I mentioned the Aspen Institute earlier. Aspen Institute receives half of its funding from the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. It is widely viewed by people that I talk to, including people currently in the intelligence community, as somewhere you go to advance intelligence community aims. The broadcast spectrum, because it has to be granted by the government, allowed for certain high levels of U.S. government control. What happens with the rise of social media? At first, the U.S. government took advantage of social media. The most famous example is Arab Spring and also the color revolutions of Europe, where the CIA, USAID, the U.S. government, U.S. government-funded entities used social media as a strategy to mobilize protests. Mm-hmm. And then once there was a lot of people in the streets, they would put pressure on the leaders to either step down or hold elections. Mm-hmm. I think it was a bit, I always point out, I think that social media in the first, in the second decade of the 21st century was similar to had the Catholic Church use of the printing press. Mm-hmm. At first, the Catholic Church liked the printing press. Mm-hmm. It was able to, well, they were able to use it to their advantage for almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. And then Martin Luther got a hold of the printing press, and he was able to print his denunciations. Mm-hmm. And at that point, censorship begins in earnest in Europe, and mm-hmm. they chase printing presses all Absolutely. Over Europe into the Netherlands. So I think that what happens after 2016, most political scientists think that Trump won with his message. He won in the debates. He won on Fox News. Mm-hmm. There was a claim that he won through the use of social media. I don't think that's accurate. But nonetheless, his use of Facebook and Twitter was so significant and powerful, as well as in Brexit, mm-hmm. that I think that the intelligence community and the ruling elites of the United States saw the writing on the wall, mm-hmm. as we say, mm-hmm. and felt that they needed to make an extraordinary effort to regain mm-hmm. control over the social media platforms.
And in a way, they were not successful. I mean, Donald Trump is president again. And I also think the comparison with the church and the printing press, I think, is a very interesting comparison, because actually I think you're right in the beginning, but it was actually for quite a short time. Okay. And then it was not, they couldn't control it anymore, because all the reformers, of course, they could also use the printing press. And Luther, as you may know, was really a bestseller author. And yes. one reason why he had to write so many, many books right. and pamphlets and so on had to do with the fact that the printers were always calling him, hey, Martin, please, another pamphlet. And yes. then he was writing it because they needed the stuff to publish. And the funny thing is actually I think it's very comparable. Censorship was actually invented at that time, of course,
yes.
and they couldn't control
right.
the freedom of press. And
right.
I think it's true also today. I mean, you did a great job with the Twitter files, but in a way it also shows it doesn't work that way.
That's
I was asking, I was wondering actually, what now? I mean, Trump was elected twice now, and of course they didn't want him to be elected. And now for you, and I have seen also your video on Trump after the election and so on, you were happy at that time as a former left-wing activist. And now, what do you think now?
Yeah, and I should say I did not vote for president. I did not vote because I wanted to remain independent. Mm-hmm. And we know that the psychology research teaches us that if you make a public commitment to somebody, mm-hmm. then that clouds your judgment. So I did not vote. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I was glad to see the change, because mm-hmm. I think that the Democrats had grown arrogant. Mm-hmm. They had become very extreme.
Mm-hmm.
They had opened the borders. They had engaged in overt racial discrimination, including with racial quotas. They had engaged in, frankly, a major medical scandal around transgender surgeries and drugs for minors who were not able to consent. And they went too far on climate change, mm-hmm. Rejecting nuclear power, insisting on only renewables, and wanting to make fossil fuels scarce and expensive. And these things were all important drivers of inflation and the public backlash to the Democrats. I would grade the Trump administration in different ways. Trump succeeded in closing the border. Mm-hmm. I believe border crossings are basically zero.
Which is amazing. And I think it's very important just to stress these points for the European audience, because people are not aware of that, because our media, they don't write about that. And I mean, it's crazy, because in Europe, all the politicians are always saying, oh, we can't do anything about that. It's kind of natural law that everybody is coming and so on. So I think this is really something, quite an achievement, actually.
It was the same thing in the United States. The mm-hmm. claim was that you can't control the border. It's too porous.
Yeah.
People can escape over it. That turned out not to be true. It's a physical process of maintaining border
right.
control. It's very secure. He's expanded energy production in an effort to bring down energy prices with the idea that would help with inflation. It's okay. Prices are still pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
He took strong action against transgender excess, which I think is appropriate. And he's gotten rid of the racialist quotas that had become toxic in, mm-hmm. in the workplace, in government, in communities, mm-hmm. And was dividing the American people in ways that were very unhealthy and in some cases dangerous. He also signed resolutions on free speech that were excellent and much stronger than we had hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think the administration has made some missteps. It has used speech that it doesn't like, particularly pro-Palestinian someone could say pro-Hamas, but nonetheless speech that it doesn't like, as the basis first for depriving people of green cards and deciding what visas they should be allowed to have, and also in terms of cutting off funding to the universities. I think the universities did require more oversight because it is public funding, but it should have been on the basis of the censorship that the universities were engaged in, not on the basis of their speech. And similarly with visas, you know, it's probably, I think the courts will probably rule that it's legal because the United States, you are allowed to decide who comes into the country. However, I, as a free speech advocate, I would rather that speech not be used as one of the, as the basis for those decisions. In terms of transparency, I frankly have been disappointed. There is a huge amount of documents that the government has on a range of issues, including the assassinations of Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, including on the Russiagate collusion hoax, on the development of the COVID vaccine, on the origins of COVID, and even on a subject that I know the Germans are excited about and is viewed as fringe, but not as the issue of UFOs or what we call unidentified anomalous phenomena. And which in all of these cases, we have identified, and I have personally requested from senior members of the Trump administration, including directly to the president and to the heads of the intelligence agencies, that they release very specific documents, including documents that have been released but have been redacted, blacked out.
What kind of documents?
On all of the issues that I named.
John F. Kennedy issues.
Yes. Right. And they
have to list. They know what you want to read.
They have the list. There, yeah. In many cases, there's documents that we know that they have. In some cases, because they've already released some of them, but in other cases, because we know that there was documents and intelligence being done on them. They have released some of them, but it's been inadequate. So I would give the administration an A- on free speech. Mm-hmm. I'd give it an A on migration, an A on race, an A on energy, and I would give it a C+ on transparency.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And tell me, is it hard to influence this administration? I mean, you are part of a, I think it's fair to say, kind of a conservative movement. There are some journalists, they are well known, and so even in Europe and so on, and they were also quite important for the election of Donald Trump. But now, is it easy to influence his policies, or is it very difficult?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure there's a straightforward answer, but I will say President Trump is very open in the sense that people might have heard that he's not allowed some journalists in, but he's also allowed other journalists in. People do criticize him, including some of the journalists that had endorsed him, including Tucker Carlson has recently criticized President Trump.
It didn't go well. It didn't go down well.
No, it's true. It's true. Obviously, there's also been a huge falling out with Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say, I think that is positive in the sense that I'm a stronger believer in the separation of powers than I've ever been. As a young man, I don't think I understood how important it was. Mm-hmm. And the centers, there's three separation of powers, obviously, legislative, judiciary, and executive. But there's also the private sector, which also acts as a counterbalance. And that's what Elon Musk did by buying the Twitter files. When Elon Musk and Donald Trump became allied, you had the two most powerful men in the world in an alliance. And you worry a little bit about that. True. So to see it fall apart, you kind of go, okay.
Yeah.
We also have a conservative Supreme Court that nonetheless has put restrictions on what the Trump administration has done, that I think are very positive, but has upset the base of the MAGA party.
Mm-hmm.
I frequently go on Fox News and other TV stations, but we know that the president watches Fox News. I know that the president has seen me on Fox News, and I have criticized the president's policies on Fox News.
And
I'm very, confident.
Did you get the call from the White House?
I haven't heard back from it.
Yeah.
I still go on Fox News,
right? Yeah.
But I'm not going to self-censor.
Sure.
After all this, I'm going to make my views known, and they are known. And I've also criticized Stephen Miller, who's the president's deputy chief of staff, who's maybe the most influential person in the administration.
Mm-hmm.
People may not realize that.
Mm-hmm.
although I'm sure the vice president and the defense secretary would object to me saying this, but very influential person. I've criticized him. They deported people. They sent them to El Salvador. I don't like how that was done. At the same time, we know that the bright line that the president absolutely must not cross is violating a Supreme Court order. And so far, in both his first term and his second term, President Trump has followed all the Supreme Court orders. And if the the best constitutional law scholar in the United States is Jed Rubenfeld at Yale University, I interviewed him about this question, and he said, if the president violates the Supreme Court order, that's when we go into the street to protest, and I will also be in the street
and
to protest.
And Rubenfeld is a Democrat or a Republican?
Jed Rubenfeld?
Yeah.
I think he like me, like every, like a lot
he
of people.
He used to be liberal and now.
Is more moderate. Okay. Yeah. But we know where, I think that's important because we know where the line is.
Right.
I think it's dangerous when you don't know where the line is.
I think that's a very important point because many people in Europe are concerned about this kind of power now coming from the White House, and people think, he's really a dictator, and so on. And as you know, in Europe, the history is very important for people. They think, there's another Adolf Hitler, and so on, which is ridiculous to my mind. But what is, in your opinion, what is the biggest misunderstanding of the Europeans about Trump? Would you tell them?
Well, I think the thing that Europeans don't understand America in several ways. Mm-hmm. The first thing that they don't understand is how important free speech is to the United States. Mm-hmm. There was a gentleman who worked for the European Commission named Thierry Breton, who headed up the enforcement of the Digital Services Act. He sent a letter to Elon Musk raising concerns about Elon Musk interviewing Donald Trump on X, formerly Twitter. Americans did not like that. And I think the Europeans did realize that because they fired Thierry Breton. But I think that you can't overstate the depth of our commitment to free speech. We will fight and die for freedom of speech in the United States. It's a sacred right for us. That's essential. And the idea that the Europeans would censor voices on the internet is very upsetting to us. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that we have a terrific constitution, it's all credit to Europe for hundreds of years since the Magna Carta of establishing excellent laws and producing John Locke, and even philosophers like Rousseau, who is not particularly supportive of the Enlightenment, but
nonetheless, Montesquieu, for example.
Montesquieu, and we had incredible. So the creators of the United States really took the best from Europe to create a brilliant constitution, also with the separation of powers, which we also owe a little bit to the indigenous tribes, interestingly enough. And so we have an absolutely brilliant constitution. We have a very strong judiciary. It's an independent judiciary. It's, there is an argument on the right that the judiciary has abused its powers by essentially deciding on total federal policy using specific local cases. But again, that's a decision that's going to be tried by the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, recognizing that Trump is moving very quickly, the Supreme Court is also moving very quickly. There was a recent issue where Trump authorized the National Guard in Los Angeles. The governor of California went to court to oppose that. One lower court decision went to the governor. An appeals court decision went to the president, and I would not be surprised if it goes to the Supreme Court.
Right. So that's the last resort.
Yeah, it's the last resort. So I think that, Trump is he is who he appears to be. He is someone who wants to get his way. He's an extremely strong person. He makes his own decisions. I think the decision to bomb these facility in Iran was Trump's decision, for better or for worse. He's also, you have to understand, I think Europeans now understand this, that he's always negotiating. So the constant exaggeration, his critics will say lying, that's how he dealt business, because he knows you start at an extreme and then you negotiate back. So I think that, is he unusual? Yes. Does he violate some norms? I think that's true, and that's a fair criticism. However, the Democrats also violated norms, including by weaponizing the intelligence community to engage in censorship and lawfare to attempt to put President Trump in prison. So our civilization is being tested. I really think that this is a critical moment for Western civilization, not just in the United States, but globally. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of reasons to be concerned about our civilization. But at the end of the day, we are a country of a constitution and laws and a powerful judiciary and Supreme Court. And that is our bright line.
I also think he's got a tremendous instinct for the important and big issues. And I also think that for Europe, he's extremely important because I don't agree with everything he's doing, of course, but I see, I mean, you were talking also about the deep state. That's also an issue in Europe, of course. And I really think this kind of opposition is important. And Trump is just now the most powerful part of this opposition. And so I think there are many, many misunderstandings in Europe, but of course, it's also hard to understand such a big country as the United States. But Michael, thank you very, very much. And I think I have to tell you that because I think free speech is also important in Europe. It's also very important in Switzerland. I know you have really made a difference in this respect. I mean, I really admire you for that. And so thank you
very much
for this conversation and the best to you.
Thank you very much, Marcus.
Thank you.
Das war Bern einfach. Der Podcast wird gesponsert von Audi Swiss, Ihrer Experte rund ums Thema Revision und Wirtschaftsprüfung. www.auditswiss.ch